Hello, everybody. This is Christopher Buck with Ohm Times, and I'm privileged today to be speaking with Colette Baron-Reed, who is, I guess you would describe her as the A-list for Hay House. She is the best-selling author of Messages from Spirit, Remembering the Future, and has just released an incredible new book called The Map, which is probably going to be the focus of the primary focus of what we're going to be talking about today. Colette, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we're definitely excited to be talking to you and looking forward to hearing about this new book of yours. The map, in general, what's it about?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so, all right, so when we say what's it about, it's a tool to help people shift rapidly out of reactivity into a more of a neutral perspective of their lives. So really, it's a fascinating tool using your imagination and symbolism and archetypes and magical, you know, it's storytelling devices as a means to shift where you're at and also just to really take a look at your life from a very, very different perceptual position.
That's fascinating. How did you, now you mentioned the archetypes. Is this like Jungian archetypes? Or
in a way, yeah. But I'll tell you that this book is really, really different from other people's works on archetypes, et cetera. Most people have, I mean, the two people that influenced this book for me, actually three. One was Clarissa Pinkola Estes with Women Who Run With the Wolves. There was a very pertinent character in her books called La Loba, which I'll tell you about in a second. But I've always been really interested in Carl Jung and his relationship to the I Ching, et cetera, since divination is a big thing, part of what I do. So I studied a lot of Jungian psychology and went to Jungian therapy based on Jung's work over the years. I've been doing readings for 22 years. So I did about 12 years of Jungian analysis myself, dream therapy, et cetera, for me. So, and then, of course, I became fascinated with Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey work. Now, lots of other authors have written books on archetypes. There's Carolyn Mace's Sacred Contracts. You have Debbie Ford working with the shadow. But you know, so I proposed a question, and the question was, if the hero is on a journey, us, and we are the hero,
uh-huh.
And if he has a thousand faces, and this adventure story of one's life is archetypal, would he not also venture through a thousand archetypal places? So the man, you know, the hero of a thousand faces has to travel through a thousand places. So rather than seeing the kind of mirror work that we do when we're looking at ourselves embodying certain or having contracts with certain archetypes, let's say like a warrior, for example, instead of saying that I am a warrior or I feel warrior feelings, I say describe what that is and say I am in a battlefield so that I travel through different landscapes. The idea of the environment actually came from a conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton, who is a colleague of mine at Hay House, when he talked about in the book The Biology of the Belief, of belief, where he said that, you know, our beliefs affect our biology, et cetera, vice versa. That is the environment of the cell that dictates the nature of the cell, not genetics. That's about epigenetics, right? So I said to him, I said, well, would that not be true then if we were to describe the environment of our thoughts, feelings, and beliefs with environmental archetypes? Like, why would we not use terms of the environment of the natural world that we know, given that it is an environment that we're traveling through? So that's what I did. I took this idea and made it user-friendly. And what I found was, you know, that it neutralized, you know, any of the big reactive feelings that we have, which so many people are experiencing now as we, you know, go through these huge transformations, both on globally, and economically, you know, the earth changes, things like that, as we come up to 2012, which again will just be another date, but that said, we really are going through a transformative process as a species. So, and if we could bring it down to that localized experience that we have, which is our own lives, we can really make magic with using this as a way to describe our experience as traveling through this evolution and continuity of a story that is no longer just about looking at our navels, but it's reorienting ourselves to our environments. Consequently, with a sort of an echo of bringing us back to remember that we do inhabit the world, and that, you know, we also remind ourselves then about the land in which we inhabit too. So there's kind of like a two-prong It's like when you hit a harmonic, you know, those tuning forks, you have the one note, but you hear the harmonic.
Right.
So what I was hoping that the harmonic of this would be was that people would start to, once they start using landscape symbolism and imagery, they'll start to look at the actual landscape, which, you know, in a different way as well.
So you see this as a tool people can look at where they are in their head, and
yeah.
and see this as a way to, because we help manifest the environment that we're a part of.
Hey,
and
well,
that,
exactly.
They could use this to plot where they need to go by 100%. Changing their focus in their head or by changing their landscape.
Well, the landscape is of the mind, right? So you know, I'll give you an example. If you say that we're in a desert, I use the landscape, meaning the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, is an environment that has,
okay,
that we look at those environments that we travel through. So say you and I are in a room together. I'll make it simple. Say you are in a room together. You're sitting beside me, and we are in the exact same physical environment. We're looking at the same thing. So our landscape is identical physically. But only 5% of reality is physical. 95% of that is the experience that we have in our thoughts, our feelings, and our beliefs. So where are we? Which is the more potent landscape, the one that we're traveling through in our mind? I could be in a pissy mood, and I'm in a rainstorm in my head. And you're all happy, joyous, and free. And you're sitting in a nice meadow in your mind. If we were to describe those feelings, say, what does joy look like to you? And maybe they're the peaks of a mountain. Maybe they're, you see what I'm saying? So if we use those archetypal language to describe where we are. So if I say, where are you right now? I say, well, I am feeling. And I say, no, don't tell me what you're feeling. Tell me what that feeling looks like. So the desert, for example, if somebody says, oh, my God, I feel like nothing is happening. I'm in a desert. Everything is dry. I say, well, keep going. What do you know about the desert? What do you know about the natural desert? Well, the natural desert, for example, teaches people how to be resilient. The life that thrives in a desert is succulent cacti. You have to go deep into the earth to get water. So I say, well, where is your water? It means you got to dig deep at that time. You got to get resilient when you're in a desert period. Or when you're in a swamp, what does that mean? Well, I'm swamped. Well, how about this? How do you get out of a swamp? Well, you got to get somebody to help pull you out. Or then you can observe that and see what's teeming in a swamp. So, wow, there's lots of stuff really there. So instead of being overwhelmed by negative environments, which is really what we want to do, is we want to help people out of the reactivity to their emotional environment. And so I help them look at it by describing it in terms that have nothing to, that are not I feel, it's I see. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do. That's fascinating, and you're right. It's very much of a new twist and a new perspective on using archetypes.
Nobody's ever done this before. I actually looked everywhere for notes on it because I thought, wow. I started reading books on eco-spirituality and in, you know, pantheism and indigenous traditions where earth, you know, earth magic, earth religions, and I was also interested in the new psychology of the environment, bioengineering, about how they look now, scientists now study, for example, animals that are waterproofed to find out the real, how do you mimic something in nature to make it work here, because it will, right? So I'm just really interested in where everybody is going right now. And there, but all the books that I read on it was way too dense and difficult to understand, right? So the eco-spirituality, et cetera, it was too hard. And I thought, well, what about, because I create oracle cards and I like those kind of fairy tales, folk tales, and I'm interested in mythology. So I looked around and said, has anybody written about this yet? But really, it's in the zeitgeist. I think somebody was going to write about it sooner than later because it is the zeitgeist. We are now definitely focused on the environment, what we have done to it. You know, our own, if we're going to look at the outside world, where we would learn about the truth about, you know, how things are meant to work in an interactive, collaborative coexistence, right, when it works the best. What do these harsher landscape offer us? So, you know, I thought, what an interesting thing. What if we applied that to feelings? Would it work? And it does. It works. So I have three questions that the book asks you to ask and answer for yourself. I ask you, where are you? If I could take 3 minutes to quickly tell you where I am in my head, I can get out of any kind of reactivity in that moment. if I'm feeling overwhelmed, I can describe my overwhelm. It's say, okay, this is what it looks like. And the minute you take the exercise, you get out of it because you engage your mind in an imaginative exercise. Straight, it's imagination. It's you know, we use, but I give you a format to use. Like, tell me what it looks like as an environment. Since you're inhabiting the thought, what does that mean? So it's like, ooh, and then you keep going and you talk, and then you can see a way out. Say, I could go there. Well, what does that feel like? And then you start to develop a relationship between this magical environment that you're creating, that you're talking to, and you see it like, oh, this is a map. And each landscape has a spirit. So if we go there, if I do use the same idea that the indigenous peoples did with the real world, say like the tree has a spirit. Well, what if the tree has a spirit in your head? So we go there, and then what does the message of that landscape say to you? What would it say to you if the desert could speak to you? What's it saying? And Carl Jung created this. It's called active dreaming, where you engage the subconscious to speak using pictures. Like, the subconscious doesn't speak English; it speaks pictures.
Right.
Right. It speaks in pictures, so it shows you things. So it sounds complicated, but it's so simple. And then you ask, when am I? So I say, where am I? When am I? And who am I listening to? So the when is like, am I in the present? Am I present? Am I really present to what I'm seeing? Or am I reacting to a potential anticipation of something horrible? Or am I being triggered on something that's happened in the past? So it's, again, that idea of mindfulness. That's my next question. I've always been interested in Eckhart Tolle's work. I found it a little complicated. So it's like, if I ask myself, when am I? Then I say, well, geez, when am I? When am I? Am I now? No, maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm ahead of myself, or maybe I'm far behind, and maybe I'm not really responding to what's truly going on. Yet again, it's a perceptual perspective shift. Then it's, who am I listening to? Well, there are voices. I'm not the first person that's created this. This was something I studied years ago called voice dialogue. Helen Cedra Stone first created this voice dialogue work. And then I just shaped it into something that I could make my own, called the Envision Process, where you have very specific voices. Rumpelstiltskin is a fairy tale that greatly influenced me when I was a kid. I was terrified of Rumpelstiltskin. And the gist of it, my mom was German, and they were like, ooh, and the German books were like really gross, and the guy had really long fingernails, and I was really terrified. I have nightmares about Rumpelstiltskin. But the gist of that fairy tale was always, there's always a teaching mechanism in folk tales and fairy tales, and basically it was, if you don't name your goblin, your firstborn will belong to him. So I took that and thought, wow, wouldn't it be more interesting to talk to your shadow, you know, much like the voice dialogue work, but make it a goblin. And I had tried to do shadow work years ago when I did a little workshop, and then my therapist said, like, if you could talk to your ego, you know, bring it up and see. So when I first did the exercise of bringing my ego forward to talk to it, I expected to have this girl who was very attractive, better looking than me, nasty, just a little bit of an edge, you know, arrogant. That's what an ego meant to me, you know, like self-centered.
But it showed up as Rumpelstiltskin?
Well, it actually showed up as a really ugly, smelly little Mr. Potato Head that drooled, that had a sign around its neck that said fat. Okay, so I just looked at my, I'm sorry, but you're going to edit this. I just about pooped my pants. So I couldn't believe it that I was seeing this in my own imagination. I'm like going, I couldn't possibly have made that up, okay? There's no way I would have come up with that, like all by myself, like creatively. I'm going to create this. So, and then I was like, oh my God, it's this ugly little goblin. And no, but it was like, after that, it struck me that I could dialogue with this ugly part of myself that I was so ashamed of. And I realized, like, wow, this is the embodiment of this ugly part of myself that I was trying to disown. And so it took you, that was 25 years ago, and I started doing readings 22 years ago. And this has stuck with me for years and years and years. And then I created this dialogue. In my first book, I talked about it, but I really delved into it in this book, really showing people what it means to have this part of us that that protects the deformed. Because, of course, in mythology, the goblin is actually a deformed gnome. And a gnome was first created by Paracelsus, and it was first used in European literature. In the 15th century, 14th century, I can't remember which century it was. Anyway, centuries ago, right? So he claimed the gnome was to protect the unformed, and that's why you have garden gnomes all over the place. It's because they protect the unformed life under the surface. but that's a metaphor. So the goblin protects the deformed. So what is deformed and what is ugly and what is wounded? So I created a story.
That's fascinating, because so many people hang on to the parts of themselves that they don't really like because they use it as a crutch mm-hmm. to prevent themselves from succeeding.
Exactly. But what I say is that the goblin's voice is mimicking your own, and that the goblin is driving the bus into Mount Hubris, right? So I have these really fun, and look, this book is not for everybody. You know, there's a lot of people who really are, you know, they'll eyebrow will go up, and, you know, maybe they'll be skeptical that it would help them. If you have an imagination and you're interested in using that imagination, this book is like creating your own fairy tale and your own mythology, so that it could speak back to you about the things that you really can't see.
I would think that would be an incredibly useful tool, especially being able to talk to your ego and not just look at the reflection, but to be able to communicate in order to learn from, so you can move past the limitations that you impose on yourself.
And you integrate it. That's the other thing. It's about integration. You cannot disown your shadow. It's impossible. A shadow is cast. You can never get rid of the goblin. What you can do is transmute it. You can give it another job. You know, energy cannot be created or destroyed. It has to go somewhere. So there are all these other characters, too, that I've created. There's a gentle gardener and a bone collector. I think the bone collector is the most powerful part of the book. And it was taken from a Hispanic folktale that someone told me many years before I read Women Who Run with the Wolves, and it was repeated in that, so we knew it was a common folktale about an old lady who collects bones and sings them back to life, the bones of a wolf. The metaphor of the bone, of course, is a bone is not easily destroyed. You can scar it, but you really takes a lot to destroy a bone. Even when you cremate people, bones are still left. You know, you have to put the temperature up majorly. So it's like really hard, and those are the things that we lose. When a goblin is born, we lose a bone in a way. We lose a part of ourselves that keeps us up and keeps us whole. But this old lady archetype, I call her the bone collector. I made it more universal. And she's in our psyches, it's really the ancient divine feminine that knows that we're whole and waits for us to claim the parts of ourselves that she holds for us on this island. So I get people to go through this metaphoric exercise. And you write letters back and forth between the different characters. It's amazing. It's based on 2.5 years of workshopping my intensive in Sedona. And now I'm going to be certifying coaches and therapists in this process, starting 40 a year I'm going to do, because I can't pay attention to more than 40 people at once. So I'm going to be taking people in Tucson, Arizona in August with David Smith from Carolyn Mace's organization.
That's wonderful. Now you mentioned the bone collector as the that facet of the divine feminine that some refer to as the crone. Now, do you have there's the divine feminine also, or often is shown in mythology and the like as you know, a youth and a middle-aged woman, and then the elderly lady. Do you have the other two facets in the map that you work with, or?
Say that again. Yes, you mean about there being another archetype of the feminine, right? Yes,
of the divine feminine.
Yeah, there's the gentle gardener is her twin sister.
Ah.
So we have the crone. I mean, there's maiden, priestess, crone in all the different mythologies. You know, you have all three, right? You have maiden, priestess, crone when it comes to the divine feminine, which are the stages of feminine expression. But I have the gentle side. There's the dark and the light, right? So the crone is wisdom, is integrated wisdom. But the gardener nurtures the seeds, plants the seeds, ensures the integrity of growth, etc. So there's a twin. You have to read the book.
I intend to read the book. It sounds fascinating. And I like the fact that you've taken these things and putting it into a way of developing or creating a story, as you say, your own fairy tale, so to speak. Because I truly believe that one of our problems in the spiritual community is we often take ourselves way too seriously.
Oh my God, yeah. And actually that's the thing. It's you really, I do everything a little bit tongue-in-cheek, too, so you really are invited. I mean, you're invited to look at some really dark stuff, too, because it's, you know, you're meant to look at things that are painful, but also to take a more whimsical approach to them. And I don't take myself seriously at all, so this book is really a reflection of me, too. I talk a lot about my own personal experiences, you know, how things affected me, talk about certain clients, but, you know, I really invite people into doing something that's a little bit more whimsical, dealing, though, with some really deep stuff. But the approach is fun. It's easy to use. It came from very complicated material and questions and complex questions, but I got simple answers, and I hope I made a very simple, easy-to-use book. It's dense. You have to do it in piecemeal. But I'm really hoping that anybody who's got an imagination can use this book.
I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to reading it. We're going to be having it, of course, featured in Ohm Times magazine this month, along with this interview, which we're very grateful for you to take the time to tell us about the book.
Thank you.
And what's coming up after this? Do you have any? What's the next milestone in the journey of Colette Barrett Reed now that she has the map figured out?
Well, you know, I'm writing another book based on the map on relationships, the map of us. But I'm teaching a class called Weight Loss for People Who Feel Too Much. So that's been amazing, amazing, amazing. Basically, just talking about disordered eating. I teach what I know. I've had this issue myself. You know, talking about as we grow more and we become more and more bombarded by world events and the fact that we're growing more into an empathic civilization, what that actually does for us around food and, how to differentiate between disordered eating and food addiction. And so that's kind of where I'm at now. But, you know, there's always something on the go. But I'm really, really most excited, to be honest with you, this summer about training people in the book, the map, like training coaches. Because I'll tell you, that's to be able to teach teachers and therapists and other coaches and intuitives to do this with people, I think I'm just so excited about that.
I would think so, because that way you can see how the work ripples out, not just from your energy, but through the energy of others.
Yeah, oh yeah. And I mean, I'm really just making sure they know how to do it. And then they can, you know, much like I loved the way Helen Cedars-Stone handled their voice dialogue stuff. You know, they didn't... You know, they just basically teach it and say, go use it, right? That's how I want to be, too. I want people just to use it. I don't want any wannabes. I don't want to be like the queen head of, you know, what I'm saying?
It's got to be exactly what you say, eyes dotted, T's crossed. You want people to bring their own flavor to it.
I do. I want people to, they can make up new characters, too, for all. I think it would be amazing. I'd love people to, I mean, have add characters to it if they want to. I mean, I think it'll be really unique and interesting to see how it evolves. I mean, I think the human imagination is the most extraordinary gift that we have, that we can consciously open up our minds and find entire worlds there that can teach us about ourselves when language limits us.
Well, I truly believe that our subconscious and the way that we hear from our subconscious, this is the medium that our soul talks to us.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
This is how we connect with divine wisdom.
I agree. I 100% agree. And when we open ourselves up, it's exactly right. Divine wisdom speaks in symbols, archetypes, oracles, kleidons. You know, there's a subtle language that doesn't speak a formalized verbality. Is that a word?
It is now. It is
well,
now.
And the interesting thing, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychotherapist, I'm an intuitive counselor, I'm a psychic, I'm a medium. I've been doing readings for 22 years. You know, I don't have a degree, but I'm a curious person who is well read. And, I mean, I didn't see the need to go get a degree. I mean, I've read enough, I probably could, but it's, you know, I think that right now I'm just offering up something that I think is creative and interesting. Everybody is looking to heal and to shift and to find some kind of help that keeps us hopeful in these really turbulent times.
It is interesting how many people are out there in need of healing and are seeking for a path to come to completeness, to come to oneness, not only with themselves, but with their environment and with, you know, humanity as a whole.
Yeah.
One of the things that we talk about all the time in Humanity Healing, or we promote, is the concept of oneness. We are one. One humanity, one earth. And there are a lot of people out there that are trying to figure out how to get to that point.
Well, so you know what's really interesting? That oneness is something, though, that can also overwhelm us. I don't think we're used to the oneness, even though we are one. The more we start to recognize we are, it's like, ooh, booga booga, right? So, you know, what does it say? What we do to the web, we do to us all, right? So that's a Native American statement. So, you know, yeah, it's interesting. I hope to God we don't find out we're an alien board game at the end of the day.
Well,
who knows, right?
The conspiracy theorists will tell you we were all created to be a something other than what I think we truly are, but that's a very negative way of looking at things.
Who said that? Who said that?
There's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there that talk about how humanity was created as a slave race in the time of Sumeria in order to feed negative energy to various entities. But it's and that's coming to fruition now through the New World Order and HARP. We see this sort of thing all the time. But it's really just a method of there's two ways to inspire people. One is to, you know, go the path you're doing, which is to guide them, and the other one is to, you know, bludgeon them with fear and push them in a direction. I subscribe more to the former, what you're doing, and as opposed to the latter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I get it. Me too. Whatever you put your attention on is what grows. I'm not interested in putting my attention on that.
Well, that's exactly right.
I'm not Pollyanna either. Well, a little bit. Listen, life is good. I love people. You know, crap happens to all of us. You know, we go to every single landscape is important. Even the valley of loss is equally as important as the peaks of joy, but we get to go to all of them, right? So, you know, so I don't know.
But I did notice you had in your landscape the Goblin Forest.
Oh, yes.
Which you said was a special place.
Yes, the Goblin Village. I've got lots of places. So, you know, we go to all these different places, and, you know, and I think that all of us as in humanity right now, we're all trying to be better people, I hope. And I'd like to believe that there's hope out there, and that hope is real.
I agree with you there 100%.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, is there any other aspect or feature or part of the book or just tidbit you'd like to share before this interview wraps up?
I don't know. You know, I think what would I like to share? I think that fear is something that can be managed. I think that, you know, fear is the one thing that's causing everybody to just kind of go off on their tangents and go into their conspiracies, etc. And really there's two choices, fear or love. And if you read this book, I believe you'll be able to unhook from fear. And you'll be able to see your life as a magical adventure. And when I say magic, I mean that it's meaningful and that there is life and that this invisible life force exists everywhere and that there's, you know, that we do have the ability to shift our perspective. And really the last thing I want to say is I hope we all play nice and do no harm.
I hope we do that also. Colette, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts and your book with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. You have a wonderful day, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Excellent.